Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome today. Back in September, at the Baltimore Book Festival, I had the privilege to moderate Writing About Family, Searching for Self, a panel discussion hosted by the City Lit Project. This panel delved deep into the personal stories of race, culture, and our country's history. You'll hear from author Dr. Lawrence P. Jackson, professor of English and African-American Studies at Emory University, and author of The Indignant Generation, a narrative history of African-American writers and critics. And he'll discuss his latest book, My Father's Name, A Black Virginia Family After the Civil War. Lawrence Jackson's also from Baltimore originally and wrote one of the best books on Ralph Ellison, written by anybody, anywhere, anytime. You'll also hear from W. Ralph Eubanks, director of publishing at the Library of Congress and author of Ever is a Long Time, A Journey into Mississippi's Dark Past. We'll discuss his most recent book, The House at the End of the Road, the story of three generations of an interracial family in the American South. How's everybody doing today? Good? All right. So this is going to be interactive, and we want you all to think of things you want to talk about, whether it comes from your own family experience, questions for both of our guests. I have the mic here. I'll walk out if you want to say something and hold it, and you can say whatever you have to say. All right? But first, the authors. What we thought we'd start with is have each person, our authors, speak for a bit about their book, to explain their book to you and the journey they took. They're both very different. One's a journey that went to Virginia to find his roots, to find out stories about the black South of Virginia and what happened and where his family was, an amazing piece of human history that Larry Jackson wrote. And this other book by Ralph Eubanks, The House at the End of the Road, is quite a remarkable story because I think it in some ways turns some of what we think is history on its head when it comes to race in the South. And so let me start, though, with Larry Jackson, Dr. Lawrence Jackson, to begin with his book, My Father.
Mark, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here today. Of course, it's sort of a homecoming for me. I was at the Pratt Library in June talking about the book to audiences, and you know, I'm delighted to be back to Baltimore again for the first time at the Baltimore Book Festival. My book, My Father's Name, An African-American Family in Virginia After the Civil War, is really it's a detective story. My dad passed away when I was in high school, when I was in college. I went to Loyola High School here in Baltimore. And when I was finishing college, my dad passed away. And when I was in the position of having children of my own, I wanted them to be able to know more about my own father and what that past was about. I mean, a person they would never meet, but somebody with such a formidable presence in my own life. My mom and dad were graduates from Morgan State College. My mother, Verna Jackson, is here with us today. And that experience was always rendered to me in really profound terms. But just understanding the migration that my father made from Roanoke, Virginia, where he grew up, and Danville, Virginia, where he was born, to Baltimore, for opportunities in the 1950s, for education, and, so that we could have a better life. I decided to name my son Nathaniel after my dad, and really I wanted to be able to share with him what some of the past had been like. The story unfolded in a rather curious way. I was just sort of looking for my father's birth certificate one afternoon when I was living in Richmond, Virginia, where the Bureau of Vital Records is. And I went down to Vital Records, and I asked to see the birth certificate. And because Jackson is such a common name, there were two Nathaniel Jacksons that had been born in 1933. And the clerk asked me to distinguish the certificates. They were two very tattered, worked-over index cards that had all of this sort of personal family information. And I looked at the card very quickly, and I said, oh, well, you know, this is my dad. And then about 10 minutes later, I got a computerized printout. And the computerized printout had only the most minimal information, not all of this rich background, the names of my great-grandparents, the place or the street address where my dad had been born that was on the index card. And I sort of had to go through a little bit of a Kafkaesque trial, a little bit of an ordeal to actually get back to the original form and to write down the information. But that sort of started the journey. In 2006, I was teaching a class on the slave narrative at Emory. Emory University sits on what used to be the Payden Plantation. You all probably know that in 1864, the Battle of Atlanta was fought. It was a major Civil War battlefield. And there was a great deal of slavery in the city of Atlanta and obviously on the Payton Plantation. In fact, one street beyond the Veterans Administration Hospital for Georgia, which is one of the boundaries of the campus, is a street called Butler's Lane. And it became Butler's Lane in the probably the teens, but at least by the 20s and 30s. But this had been the historic place where the quarters had been located on the Payton Plantation. So I'm going through the slave narrative. We're actually living in a place in a geography that was very rich with the history of slavery. And the students were falling asleep. I mean, they were literally falling out of their chairs, right? They couldn't maintain attention on, the story of William Wells Brown, the story of Frederick Douglass, the story of Harriet Jacobs. And so I got the idea that maybe if I showed them a little bit about how personal the experience of slavery was to modern-day Americans, that it might in some way sort of jolt their interest or wake them up. And so I made a PowerPoint presentation using the Ancestry.com database, and I basically just showed them the census slides for members of my mother's family in 1860 and 1850. And my mom has a free ancestor in 1860, a guy named Nathaniel McClinn. And then in 1850, he disappears, okay? And, you know, he seems to have been someone. This looks like we're going to have a weather event. This is great.
That's because every time we do this, and I do it, it's a weather event. It's a connection.
But a man who seemed to have been biracial, possibly related to the person who owned him, who had the same surname. You know, he's frequently listed or enumerated in the census as mulatto. And then in 1850, you can't find trace of him. And if you look at what are known as the slave schedules from the 1840s and the 1850s and the 1860s, you find out that people of African descent are enumerated not by name but by category, by their probable age, by their gender, and by their color, either black or mulatto. I don't know if it did much for the students in the class, but it really did something for me. And what happened was that in about 18 hours, I had the actual names of more direct kin than I had known my entire life. And I had no idea that I would be able to get back to people as far as, 1870 or possibly even 1860 in the unlikely event that you had a free ancestor. There are roughly 450,000 free African Americans in 1860. So then I started wondering about my dad's side of the family, and, I'm Jackson, so I wanted to know about the Jacksons. And I hoped that I could basically find out who my grandfather's parents were and possibly know more about who had been involved in slavery themselves, physically had been enslaved. And I suppose just to get to the quick of this story, what I couldn't believe and that I found out fairly rapidly by about 2008 was that my father's grandfather was born in slavery and endured life as a slave for about 10 years and then grew to manhood in the great flux and chaos and racial strife that was Reconstruction in the United States. And a lot of us, and I would include myself, we think of Reconstruction, especially 1865 to 1877, we think of it in some ways as sort of glorious period of African-American freedom. If you're in South Carolina, for example, if you're in Mississippi, African-Americans are very successful in gaining elected office. I mean, it's sort of remarkable. Even in Virginia, as late as the late 1880s and in 1890, an African-American would go to Congress, John Mercer Langston. However, it's important to remember that during this period, apparently there are only about 10,000 federal troops throughout the entire South. So we have this illusion, sort of that U.S. troops are backing up black rights, but it simply didn't exist that way. In fact, the Freedmen's Bureau in the part of Virginia that my ancestors lived in Pennsylvania County, they were inundated with these cases where recently freed people, black Americans, were pressing their rights and where they were being horribly taken advantage of. I mean, often losing life and limb in contest with often returning Confederate soldiers, former landholders. I mean, it was really an extraordinary period that people were lucky to survive the famine, the mass sickness and disease that that took place when people collected in cities and towns. I mean, it was really quite extraordinary. So I found out about an ancestor named Edward Jackson, and the story really is about uncovering Edward Jackson's early life and the life of his father-in-law, a man named Granville Hundley, who bought 40 acres in 1877. Nobody gave him the 40 acres and a mule, right? That's another one of our myths. That's part of our mythology, right? Granville Hundley paid, I think it was $240 to the man who seems to have owned him for his, you know, basically a headright. 40 acres is a fairly small farm for farming people. And he actually was the pioneer of a black community in Pittsylvania County. The dramatic climax of this book really comes in the conclusion. I mean, of course, it has to come in the conclusion. And it talks about perhaps the pivotal day in the life of my great-grandfather, Edward Jackson, June 14th, 1860. So one of the mysteries of the book was that I found a marriage certificate from 1878, and I was trying to find out who Edward's parents were. And he says on the marriage certificate that his mom and dad were Sandy and Jenny Dickerson. I never found a Jenny Dickerson in the county after 1870. She never comes up in any formal records. And Sandy Dickerson lived in a place called Chatham, which is today it's the county seat. It's where the courthouse is. Sandy lived there with a younger wife, and there were many young men named Sandy Dickerson living in the local area. I could never figure out why he picked that couple. And, I said, well, maybe they were people who he admired, and he just decided he had to put down somebody on the marriage certificate, and he was going to have parents, Sandy and Jenny Dickerson. About 2 years later, at the University of Virginia Library, at the Small Special Collections, I was reading through a box of Pittsylvania County ledgers, and I found a document that was just called an account book, and it was written by a man named Vincent Dickerson. And it was an account book of an estate sale. And on June 14th, 1860, Sandy and Jenny Dickerson were sold. And Sandy Dickerson was sold to a slave trader, and Jenny Dickerson and two children were sold to someone else. And the family never seems to have come together again, and it is my belief, I think there's high probability, that Edward Jackson winds up being portioned out to a relative of the slave owner and took a name of a local person who owned a mill years later in 1870 when he had the opportunity to be enumerated on a U.S. Census. So, you know, I hope that we get a chance to talk a little bit more about this. The book really wants to dig not just into my own personal history, but it's very much a Pittsylvania County, Virginia history. Pittsylvania County history, the best known one was written in 1929, and it is very much an apology for the plantation regime and for slaveholders. The book also wants to get at the unseemly, very difficult side of American slavery, and in that way, I mean, I think because it's wanted to be in such a personal account, I think that it's an effective book that way. So I hope we get to talk about it further. Thank you.
Ralph Eubanks, please.
I mean, I'd say there's some real parallels between our kind of wanting to know about our families. I chose to write about my maternal grandparents, Jim Richardson and Edna Howell Richardson, who were an interracial couple in Alabama who married around 1915. I got started on this because in my first book I wrote about this aspect of my family's history in about one paragraph. And my editor said, I really want you to tell me more about this. This is really all that I know that's in this one paragraph. And, you know, as after a while, things start coming back to me, remembering one thing, the picture of my grandfather that stayed in the closet when I was growing up that never hung in the house. So I grew up in Mississippi, and in Mississippi in the 1950s and 60s, there was something called the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission. And one of the things that they would do is, blow the horn here now for the train. One of the things that they would do in Mississippi, the Sovereignty Commission, is something you did not do was to claim kinship with a white person. So that's one of the reasons that picture never hung in my house. So that really started to come, remind me of that aspect of it. And it's a photo that my mother gave me when I married, as if to say, here's his picture, you've been fascinated with him, why don't you figure out his life? And other memories really started to come back to me, remembering that I didn't always know that my grandfather was a white man. My mother talked about him as this really brave man who stood up to the Klan. It wasn't until I was 16 and I overheard my parents talking late one night, and I heard my father tell my mother that the hardest thing he ever did was to ask a white man to marry his daughter. And I thought, my grandfather's a white man, and then I just kind of went back to sleep as if none of that really mattered to me. I mean, this is about 1973. I'm 16 years old. It's kind of the height of the Black Pride movement. None of this really matters to me at all. And it's not until I'm actually taking my mother to see my daughter at kindergarten about Thanksgiving one day that this whole story, realizing that I had to tell this story, started to come out. My mother went in with my daughter and asked her to write a story about a Thanksgiving that she would never forget. And she sat there very patiently and told her about this Thanksgiving where her mother's friend, Miss Callie, came, and she cooked a big dinner, and they sat around and they played games together, and that it was a day that she would never forget. And as we were leaving the school, I could tell my mother was really upset, and I said, "Why don't you tell me more about that Thanksgiving?" And she said, and she just kind of turned to me and was ramrod straight. She said, "That was the Thanksgiving my mother died." So my mother was 7 years old, her mother died, and this lady, Miss Callie, who was actually, I come to learn, is really the help, was there taking care of them. And she said that I sneaked around the house, trying to see my mother. She went and looked at her in her casket in a pale blue dress with a lace collar, a dress that my grandmother had made herself. And then all of the mirrors in the house were covered with sheets. And I guess to kind of keep her spirit at rest for some reason. I hear that's very much a Jewish tradition. I don't know how that ended up in coming about in my family, but all the mirrors were covered with sheets. And then she remembered that there was talk about what was going to happen to them after her mother was buried. So, would she stay there? And then my grandfather has to take her off to Mobile to stay with relatives for a while. And there was some talk about actually leaving there, going away to Pass, going up north to Pass. And my grandfather decided, no, they're going to face up to who they are, and I'm going to raise them. So that's what he did. So I went back to Alabama to try to find out how to piece a lot of this story together. A lot of it really is part of family lore. I didn't have as many documents as Larry had, but I took the lore that I heard orally from the oral histories I collected and what few documents I could find, and then went into things like land records to piece certain aspects of the story together. For example, the house at the end of the road that is referenced in the title of the book, the house was literally at the end of a road, and it was there, I built there, I believe, because once you got to the end of the road and you wanted to mess with my grandfather, you were his. And which is what he did with the Klan when they actually came down there. He filled them full of buckshot, some of them were his own relatives, sent them on their way, and they never came back. But I wanted to piece together this story about them, so going into the land records to find out when they actually built the house being deeded to my grandmother, since their marriage wasn't recognized as being legal, which meant that if anything happened to him, she couldn't inherit the property. So I see that he deeded the land to her, and then over time, seeing that he deeded land to his children, since in the laws of the state of Alabama, they were considered to be illegitimate because the child of an interracial couple, it was not a legitimate marriage. They couldn't inherit property or any of his liquid assets. So he made sure that they were left property. And then this whole story started to get me into, you know, much deeper aspects of race and identity, really thinking about contemporary issues of race and identity. I ended up, in the course of this, having my DNA analyzed to try to look at where some of my ancestry came from through DNA. And then also thinking about, you know, one of the things I didn't expect to happen with this book is I thought that I would learn the story of my grandparents, which I did. I learned a lot about their lives. But I think probably the most important thing was I learned a lot about myself. And I learned to, these new ways of thinking and feeling and acting about race that that the philosopher Anthony Appiah speaks of in his writing. It's really become very much a part of my life, is that my mother, I grew up hearing my mother say, you can always tell when someone's passing. You know, I could just always tell. And I'd say, well, how? And she, it was more lore than anything. So one of the things that I've learned to do is to, I really don't look at someone and claim to know their story. You can't look at someone and say, I know your background, I know all about you. It's that you really have to try to interact with that person as another human being. Those ideas of personal identity come out much later on in the course of the relationship. So I think that's probably the most significant thing that I really learned in the course of this, was really looking at the world very differently and looking at people very differently and not really always through the lens of race.
Could Mark, you mind if I...
Yeah,
Ralph, you raise an interesting point about how you know people and the kinds of markers that you use to understand and to make decisions, how you judge people. And at the end of my journey with this book, the very last thing that I talk about actually finding the land that Granville Hundley owned, the 40 acres. And as you can imagine, that was a big part of the quest. And I actually drew up or mocked up a map that sort of showed his holdings. But the way that I was able to determine one of the boundaries is because the house of the key landholder in his neighborhood has been lovingly refurbished. It was a doctor. His name was Edward Williams. And his house was constructed in 1858. It stands today, and it has been absolutely, sort of lovingly taken care of. And his cemetery plot, it has Edward Williams and his wife and their children. And when I found that house, I knew that Granville Hundley's land was just adjacent to it, and that the creek down the hill from the Williams land was basically where Hundley had lived. And I was invited inside when I got information about who Edward Williams was. The doctor apparently, you will enjoy this, or you will sort of flinch when I tell you, the doctor apparently expired by inserting a turkey quill as a catheter in 1907. So that was his final moment. And this was a guy who had a fairly small farm, but he owned about 15 or 20 people in the last census during enslavement. And it was interesting having the discussion with this family. And in fact, I was told that I was invited inside to the inner sanctum. They had in their hallway a bust of Robert E. Lee, and in the side of the kitchen, they had ceramic figures of black caricatures, darky stereotypes in sort of ceramic figures. And over the mantle, he had a Kentucky long rifle. He had an Enfield rifle that was popularly used by the Confederate troops. He had all of this 19th century firearms, and I'm sure underneath his seat he had a 9mm or a Tech 9 or something else, But when they asked if I wanted to have coffee with them, I said no. I felt like that was that I potentially might have been dishonoring my ancestors. And I know that it's an imaginary idea that I have about who my ancestors were and the kinds of negotiations that they made under the regime of slavery and what came after. But it did not seem to me to be the right thing to do. And then later that evening, I went to a diner, or just a couple minutes later, I went to a diner, and this is actually the last paragraph of the book, and I was having a conversation with a guy who had been who grown up in New Jersey and had come back to Danville to be with his mom's family and to sort of find himself after having gone through incarceration, after now he was stuck in a series of minimum wage jobs because he had some court judgments against him for child support, but who was at a in some ways was at a low point or a rebuilding point in his life. I mean, a fairly young man. And what was interesting was that with his last name, I knew that his family had survived enslavement and that some of them had actually, they'd either run away or they had an interesting connection to some freed people. In our old neighborhood, there were some strong Igbo connections or Igbo, some residues of Igbo culture that survived enslavement and into the 1870s and 1880s. And I knew this about his stock, if you will, or, you know, the people that he came from. And I tried to inspire him as well as I could. I mean, you know, you're just sort of meeting somebody very randomly. He actually started the conversation with me because of the way that my beard was cut, right? He asked me if I, too, was from the Northeast because of the way I was wearing my facial hair. But those kinds of moments, I mean, I found myself in some ways still very much trying to balance this thing about what appearances meant and what was behind the appearances. And there was definitely a great deal of tension, but I also thought there was some beauty that availed itself because of some of those judgments.
Please don't go away, because we're going to be right back after this very brief break to continue our discussion with authors Lawrence B. Jackson and W. Ralph Eubanks.
Out of those judgments, but I think oftentimes they can be barriers to actually kind of carrying on an honest discussion. And I think it's something that actually had come up as I was trying to have some conversations with some of my white relatives and trying to get them to be open and honest with me about the feeling about the family, because what everyone in the family said is that when you were in the woods with your white relatives, it was fine, but you didn't want to see them on the streets in town, because then it was as if they didn't know who you were. And I couldn't really get any of them to admit that. But one time I had a conversation with a relative that I thought was going to be a little bit fraught with difficulty, and it was the most honest discussion we had. And he said, I'm just worried that you're coming down here trying to make your grandfather into some kind of a saint. And I said, well, I know he was not a saint. I said, I actually know that he killed a man on a train once, and I know my grandfather was a bootlegger. And one of the reasons I think my grandparents were never prosecuted for interracial marriage, since Alabama has the largest number of prosecutions for interracial marriage of any state in the union that had miscegenation laws, is because my grandfather was a bootlegger and he knew everyone's secrets. But we had this really open conversation that really came out of something where there was some real tension, where he thought I was actually trying to really cast my grandfather as this racial, this pioneer for racial equity. And he was just a man. And I think that made a big difference in where that conversation eventually went. And then actually becoming very friendly with him.
This was actually a great struggle for me, how you balance what you find at the courthouse, what you find in the archives, what you find on the microfilm, and talking to living people, talking to descendants, survivors, relatives. My journey really began, I'd forget this part of it, but in 2004, I took an afternoon and I went back to Blair's outside of Danville looking for my grandfather's house. And the only piece of information that I had was that my grandfather lived by the railroad tracks. And so basically I spent about 4 hours driving around, you know, rural Virginia, and just asking people at random, hey, if you were a black man in the early 1970s and you had a small two-room house by the railroad tracks, where would it have to be? Okay, just that much information. And it was fascinating. Here again, I was making all kinds of judgments about people, especially racial judgments, trying to get closer to the truth. At the end of the, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, sort of again wandering around for a while, I got some information from my mom. I mean, I guess thank God for cell phones. And she said, well, you know, your grandfather didn't live on a regular road. And so I stopped looking for, you know, street signs, and I looked for places where you could just sort of drive off. And I drove off behind a car wash, and then I saw a log cabin right by the railroad tracks. And I said, you know, I mean, I can't possibly have forgotten that he lived in a log cabin. That's something that would have, you know, sort of stayed in my memory, especially I was at the great Davy Crockett phase of life when we would go visit Grandpa Jackson in the country. And two white men were coming out of the house at that time, you know, beer bottles, Thunderbird wine bottles in hand. And one of them looked like somebody who just wandered off the set of a Civil War movie. And I was saying to myself, oh, you know, I mean, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to, I don't know what I'm going to do here. But I've been telling the story all day long. And so I said, hey, you know, can you help me? I'm looking for my grandfather's house. And we actually went then to the place where my grandfather lived. And it was confirmed for me in a conversation that I had with the African-American man who was living there, who was getting the house from my cousin. What I'm getting to is that after finding Grandpa's house, I then went to my father's first cousin's homes. They lived about a half mile away. And one of the tragedies or tragic portions of the story was that even though I had that moment of reconnection with them, you know, on a December afternoon in 2004, it didn't revive a robust family connection. You know, when I go through Pennsylvania and I have the kids, I mean, I want to stop, or I sometimes do stop, but I'm not calling in advance. Everybody's out. The last time that I went through there, some of the people who wind up being very integral in the story, they'd passed away. I mean, they were fairly young people in their late 50s, early 60s. And so that was a real tension for me. I mean, actually making a real connection with people. I mean, I made a connection with the story, and I made a connection with, you know, sort of what I know how to do. I mean, I'm a professor. I mean, and I write. But in terms of it reconnecting the Jackson family, I'm not so sure.
May I ask you this question and see if you all have some comments and thoughts for our authors as well. One of them is there's a quote that always sticks in my head, especially in these kind of stories. And it's a quote from George Orwell. And George Orwell said that he who controls the past controls the future. And he who controls the present controls the past. And that's always been a very profound piece, he said. I'm coming from a very profound fellow himself, George Orwell. But I'm curious, in terms of that quote, why what the two of you are doing, do you think, is important beyond the familial history, beyond your own self-discovery? Because here we live in the United States of America where, especially in the African-American world, the past is cut off. It belongs to somebody else in a literal sense, as it belongs to the folks who lived it in a very literal sense. So I'm curious why, beyond your personal stories, how they're connected and why they're important beyond just your exploration.
I would have to say, for me, the reason I felt the story was important is, you know, we in the 2010 census, you know, we found that we have a large number of multiracial people in this country. It's growing. My home state of Mississippi has the largest rate of interracial marriage of any other state in the union. Which is something that you...
Mississippi.
Mississippi. Wow. Yep, Mississippi, goddamn. They sure do. and I was really thinking about this in the context of how, as this world really changes and people are identifying themselves differently and much more fluidly, you know, my mother's family really having that black identity at their core, and people saying, you know, I'm not black, I'm multiracial. Well, what does that actually mean? So how does the multiracial past connect with the multiracial future and actually what the issues that are going on now? Because I don't think people think that there was really this multiracial past because it was hidden off in the shadows. And when I tell people that my grandparents married around 1915 in Mississippi because my grandmother was probably light enough to pass, and they could. There was no waiting period in Mississippi for a marriage license, but that marriage was illegal in Alabama because they knew them there. And, you know, people look at me, no, that couldn't have been. And I had to just really say, yes, it was. So the this part of history is really connected as well. And also, I think there's so much about that period that people don't know about and that the history has been wrong. And that's one of the things I really wanted to correct.
Larry?
Since there were so little credible history about Pittsylvania County, I mean, writing the history of a county, and I found that very empowering. I think it's something that people might actually get from the book. I mean, I'll just give you one small example. In the 1930s, Sterling Brown was the head of the Bureau for Negro Affairs for the Federal Writers Project, and he was very important in getting people to conduct interviews of ex-slaves, and to basically they recorded some of these accounts, but there were more than 3,000 that were taken. And several generations later, they became the bedrock of our historical understanding of what enslavement was about. And so they conducted a couple of interviews in Pennsylvania. One of the people who was recorded was actually not a woman. She was born about 1867, and she actually gave stories that her parents had told her. And what was fascinating was that her father was sort of a famous rogue from the slaveholder's point of view, a famous rogue in the county. He was like a medicine man or a conjurer, and he had openly defied the overseer, or was known to openly defy the overseer and the overseer's family. And one of the stories that she told was to name one of the most prominent slaveholders in the county, a guy named Robert Wilson, and to say that Robert Wilson was the source of the brutality that African Americans received. As we all know and understand, the slaveholders themselves as a group would always try to remove themselves from, you know, sort of openly meting out punishment, right? That office was reserved for working-class white Americans, right? And, of course, this is the historic animosity between blacks and whites of the working class. I mean, or really just sort of blacks and whites generally, right? And fascinatingly enough, she had the presence of mind during the interview to really drive home this point. And so what I found myself doing was finding history out about this guy, Robert Wilson, and the neighborhood that she lived in and how she got these stories and who they would have been popular among, and the different traditions that were known around the time that she was a little girl, who was about the same age as my great-grandmother, Celestia Hunley Jackson. So, Mark, all I can say is that sort of presentist movement to recover and rewrite the past, I mean, I thought that was part of the contribution I was trying to make.
And set the past straight. Now, anybody have a comment? What I'm going to do is, partially because it's always safer to do, let me get this mic unraveled here. I'm going to hold the mic and let you have to say, rather than hand you the mic, all right? So, sir.
First of all, I'd like to commend you both for your contributions to the book and sharing it with the audience. I'd like to know, if you can you elaborate on the effects of religion in your family's diversity, being a multicultural relationship? How did that influenced and kind of held them together in any way?
How religion really... well, you know, it's interesting.
Ralph, let me get you closer to your mic.
My family was part of an AME church in the little town of Prestwick, Alabama, and my grandfather was not much of a churchgoer, neither was my mother, but he actually... he bought the piano and regularly contributed to building the church there, even though he rarely went to church. Sadly, when he did go to church, that is where he went, but he could not be buried in the churchyard with my grandmother. My grandparents are buried in two different cemeteries, both Methodist cemeteries, but one is a white cemetery. When my grandfather died, his family asked for him to be buried with his family. And my mother said, well, if we've had him all these years, if they want him now, they can have him back. So that's why he's buried there.
You know, interestingly enough, there wasn't so much that came up about organized Christianity. I, too, like Ralph, I wound up taking the DNA test after this project was completed, and I did the paternal DNA test, and, you know, there's definitely very many minds about the validity of these tests, but some of the information that came back suggests to me that my father's ancient ancestors, the part of West Africa that they come from is has been Muslim for a very long time, and they actually seem to be in an arc of the you know, some of the Muslim areas. And it suggests to me that, you know, I mean, I could probably be descended from somebody who was an enslaved Muslim who came to the United States or came to North America, to the English colonies in North America, sometime at the end of the 17th century, at the beginning of the 18th century, when, you know, trade with some of those areas on English ships was quite prominent. And that that was a tradition that's been silenced and perhaps leading to, you know, one of these interesting facts that we don't know that much about, or we don't sort of deal with. But some of the historians would suggest that prior to 1860, only about 20% of African Americans are Christian, are practicing Christianity, and that that it's actually a much greater diversity of religious influences and worship styles that are enabling people to survive slavery. As I mentioned earlier, one of the astounding things that I found out was that the community where my my great-great-grandfather Granville Hunley owned land was that it seemed to have been almost like a kind of an Igbo confederation. One of the things that was prominent among the Igbo of the Niger Delta in West Africa is to name a male child doctor, after the science of doctoring or conjure science, Dibia, Obia, and which comes over to the West Indies as Obia. And in Pennsylvania County in 1870, they're still naming male children doctor. In fact, there's a couple that names a male child doctor about 1864, when I'm sure they were getting all of these reports like, hey, you know, they're getting ready to take Petersburg, Atlanta fell, and, you know, this war is going to be over and we're going to be able to worship as we like and to celebrate our families, and they won't be torn apart by slave sale. So,
any other questions? Please, I'll come over there.
Yes, to answer your question, I'm grateful that these two men are here and that they recorded their journey in two books for two reasons. Because I can relate to this gentleman here. My father had a book, which I now have, which belonged to my great-great-great-great-grandfather. And it's actually a ledger. And he kept all the information about his family, how he built his house, the materials, his children, the dates that they were born, including, you know, my great-great-grandmother. He had property in Baltimore. He had property in Virginia. And I got a call about 10 years ago, and my sister had the book. She had taken it from my mother, the ledger, because my mother was not taking care of it. And she said, if anyone is going to do anything with it, she said, Linda Kay, you're the one. So I put that aside for a minute. And when I went to college, I began to feel this tremendous void about my own history. Now, when I was a teenager in the 70s, black students were, college students were protesting to get one black history class in college. So now we're seeing how that has progressed. So you can imagine my void. I don't know how black people have contributed to this country. So I made a promise to myself. When I went to college, regardless of what class it was, if I was given an opportunity to select my topic for a research paper, that I would explore parts of my black history. So that's what I did. I majored in sign language interpreting, so I did a research paper on unique challenges for black interpreters. That was very interesting. In my English class, my professor suggested that I, he wanted something controversial, so he suggested that I study Ebonics. Never knowing that Ebonics is the language and culture of the black people, that was really eye-opening. In art class, I studied black quilts and learned a lot about that history. So it's all starting to come together, and these two gentlemen are helping me on my journey to find out who was this black man who had beautiful, beautiful handwriting that owned property in Baltimore, in Virginia. I was really fascinated about it. He was part of the Masons. He was the secretary. All this information is in this book, and I want to bring it together for myself as well as for my family. So they are helping me. They're motivating me to continue this journey because it's going to be a long one. It's not going to, you know, everything is not coming together right away. And I'm certainly going to read their books. So I'm the present, and I'm still young enough to be the future.
Man. But I think this is, so talk a bit about how, from what you were just saying, how people start this journey.
Really, I guess how you start a journey like this is really just, I think for me it was really just starting to, what really started me on this was going, when the Sovereignty Commission files were opened in 1998, actually started me to write about my family and the past in Mississippi, which is what got me starting to write about my grandparents, and then kind of launching me into that as well. So it's really, there's a kind of a whole series of events for me that that really got me started down that path. It didn't start out to write about family as such. Actually, I think I started out wanting to write about the Sovereignty Commission from the standpoint of kind of a narrative history, looking at the people who were involved in it, not really realizing that I was also part of the story itself. So I think that's really what got me started down this route, was really seeing how sometimes you're looking at history from up here and you're thinking about all the other players and not really realizing that within that history you play a role in it. And I think that's what really set me off on that path.
Larry?
Sorry, I wasn't that way.
But you're a teacher. We were talking about what the woman was talking about earlier, about how you even take the first step on this journey.
Well, for me, again, it helps if you have a little, the motivation of wanting to give the children a record. So that was the thing that really got me, you know, feeling like, oh, you know, I should really try to put some of this story down. And a kind publisher sometimes helps, too, for book-length manuscript. Interestingly enough, one of the things that helped me was that I was working on another book which was in production, and I had the moment to sort of get down these family ideas, and it was a sort of a side story, and so I think that was a big part of it for me too. It was sort of my creative outlet when I was working on an academic project.
One of the things I was thinking about in both your books, and I read your book a while back, Larry, as you know, but is that When there's a disconnect in our history, there's a disconnect to the present. And the power coming at this moment, I want to talk about a bit, is that when so many young people in this country, young African-Americans in this country, don't know history, and rewriting the history now is important because there's a new history coming out to talk about that, and also to understand that the history of black America is the history of all America. I mean, that's what I got from both your books. Whether it was little pieces of history you threw out about Southwest Alabama and the madness that took place there, the outlaw ways of that place, or your all your stories about, you know, what hit me so deeply, Larry, in your book was when you wrote about the breeding that took place on plantations, equating African Americans, equating slaves with animals and husbandry and cows and pigs. I mean, and it's the pieces you bring out or pieces we have to understand for ourselves.
I mean, I think the reason we have to understand this, I think it's what this woman here was talking about. There's a piece missing, and then you somehow have to fill it in. And I think that's a really important part of, you know, telling these stories that are really connected. I think really the connection between both, I'd say, memory and history, because I think those two things are separate and distinct, but sometimes they really do come together. I think at least for me, there's so much that was part oral and part of memory, but then how does that really fit in with the history?
There are debates underway. I mean, there are longstanding debates about the nature of American slavery that I wanted to participate in. And one of them now would suggest, for example, people would write really wonderfully wrought studies that would give so much agency to people of African descent under the regime of slavery. And I think in some ways what I was interested in doing was perhaps going against that grain a bit, because there's not very much information that you have access to, or in some ways that you will ever have access to. I mean, there's some definite qualitative limits when you confront the Schedule II with the number of the age and the gender and whether the person is mulatto or black. We'll pause for our
train.
And of course, what I would understand as being the danger, or the thing that perhaps worries me a bit about trying to read so much humanity into people when they are under a regime of slavery, is that inevitably it will diminish the severity of the condition. And a lot of my book also has to do with race and poverty, which I am a person who thinks is very much connected to the condition of slavery and labor exploitation practices that are perfected at that time and that continue in our own moment. And, so I'm a bit skeptical about some of the things that took place in the 19th and the 20th century, and I would like very much that skepticism to keep riding with us as we prepare our histories of the contemporary period and the future.
So Dr. Lawrence Jackson, My Father's Name, Ralph Eubanks, The House at the End of the Road. Thank you both so much for being at the book festival. Thank you all for being here. And there will be a book signing at the author sign tent down by the Literary Salon. Actually, I'm wrong. It's right here. So there. Buy a book. Get it signed. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed and were as fascinated as I by this discussion about race, culture, and heritage with Dr. Lawrence P. Jackson and W. Ralph Eubanks. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Marbronis, and Mark Henry. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews. Clean Cuts, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.